31. In love, Frankie learned to lie. It was one of two new constants in her life, lying and loving Rye throughout that long, lazy summer. She didn't tell anyone she'd been suspended from nursing, and so she had hours when no one expected to hear from her. She lived frugally on her savings. Her life alternated between two worlds, one of passion and the other of guilt. Day after day, she promised herself no more. No more pills, no more Rye. He was as much a drug as the others. She swore each day she'd tell him to go away and not come back until he was divorced. But when he showed up at her door, wearing a smile just for her, she was lost. And as good as it felt to lose herself in his arms, the pleasure turned cold when he left her bed. Each day, she was reminded of her weakness, her dishonesty, her immorality, her obsession. Over and over and over. At night, when she was alone, she agonized that he was in bed with his wife, and she imagined the pain this affair would cause the innocent Joey. But as much as she despised herself, she couldn't deny him. She was like a starving person who was given 2 hours a day in a bakery, and in those hours, she came fully, gloriously alive, reveled in her appetite. "Stay the night this time," she pleaded at last, hating the plaintive edge to her voice. She meant, choose me, but she knew he couldn't do it. He and Melissa were talking to a lawyer. He was looking for his own place, but he couldn't do anything to upset his custody of Joey. He loved his daughter with abandon. "You know I can't," he said, stroking her bare arm as they lay together in bed. She couldn't help looking at the clock. 3 p.m., She felt the incipient spark of panic, the sharp sting of regret. Regret that he was leaving, or that she'd let him stay.
"I can't wait for you to meet Joey. She'll love you," he said.
Frankie let herself be soothed by that. "I hope so. And we'll have children too, right?"
"Of course. I want a daughter who looks just like you."
He smiled.
"Joey wants a brother or sister. She says it constantly."
"I love you," she said, rolling toward him. She traced the scars on his shoulder with her lips. Puckered burns covered his chest, created white patches of skin amid the graying blonde hair. She stretched out against his thin body, pressing into him.
"I wish I'd been the one writing you letters."
"Me too, babe. I care for Missy, but this, you, soon we can stop hiding."
His hand moved down her bare skin. Need pulled at her, made her move against him, made her breathing speed up. She rolled onto her back, gave him full access to her body. His kisses awakened the part of her that belonged only to him. By summer's end, Frankie was a knot of nerves. All of the waiting, the hoping, the hiding was tearing her to pieces. She was lying to everyone she knew, and she hated it. She'd taken off her St. Christopher medal and hidden it away, afraid it would burn her skin while she slept. She needed more pills to sleep and more pills to stay awake. Still, she went on with the affair, waiting every day for the moment she could announce the truth to her friends and family and unpack this terrible, oppressive guilt. She avoided answering the phone. Lying to Barb or Ethel was impossible, but neither could she tell them the truth. She returned calls when she knew they'd be gone, or hung up when one of them answered. Never had she imagined herself to be the woman that she'd become. Loving Rye had transformed her into a liar. Every night, alone in her bed, she prayed that tomorrow he would say it was done. They could be together, walk hand in hand in the sunlight, spend the night together. Each morning, she felt another piece of her soul fall away. In August, when she got Barb's excited phone call that she was getting married, Frankie's first reaction was a searing, toxic jealousy that took all her will to suppress. Now she was in a Chicago park on a sweltering, hot, late summer day, standing in front of a few guests who sat in folding chairs, already drinking champagne. The aisle had been strewn with red rose petals. Ethel and Frankie, both dressed in brightly colored geometric print palazzo jumpsuits and white sandals, stood by a wooden arch that had been decorated with flowers and greenery. Next to them, under the arch, was the groom, in a brown polyester sport coat with matching slacks. His twin boys were his groomsmen. A Baptist minister held on to a Bible. A portable cassette player with not great speakers played Jim Croce's Time in a Bottle as guests took their seats. Ethel swayed to the music, quietly singing along. At the end of the aisle, Barb waited impatiently. She was dressed in a flowy white jersey halter dress, her hair decorated with flowers. She held on to her mother's arm. When the last guest was seated, Barb gave the thumbs up. Ethel went to the portable tape deck, changed the music, and turned it up on Here Comes the Bride. Barb and her mother walked slowly down the aisle, past the smiling collection of friends and family who were here, a few of Barb's relatives from Georgia, some of her co-workers at Operation Push, Jer's ACLU colleagues, and Ethel's husband Noah and their daughter Cecily. Barb was smiling so brightly, it made Frankie's whole life look tawdry, sinful. There, she thought, that's love. The way Barb kissed her mom and helped her into her chair in the front row, the way Jer looked at his bride. Love. A thing to be shouted from the rooftops, celebrated, not cultivated in secret and clipped into shape in the dark. Dearly beloved, the minister said. The music snapped off. Barb and Jer held hands, stared at each other. The minister's voice went on, saying the words she'd heard at other weddings and on television and in movies. Old words. Love. Honor. Commitment. And as much as Frankie wanted to celebrate with her friend, as much as she rejoiced in Barb's new love and new life, she felt that toxic shame growing in her, pushing kinder emotions aside. She closed her eyes and imagined herself beneath the arch, with Rye at her side and Joey strewing flowers. She heard Jer say, "From now on, Barbara Sue, I am here for you, standing beside you. To paraphrase Yeats, I love the pilgrim soul in you and love the sorrows of your changing face, always and forever." He placed a ring on her finger. "Barbara Sue Johnson," the minister said, "do you promise to love, honor, and obey Jeremiah Maine as long as you both shall live?" "I do," Barb said, beaming at him as she fit a plain gold band on his finger.
"You may kiss the bride," the minister said.
Jer pulled Barb into his arms. She clung to him, kissed him. When they drew apart, they were both laughing. The music changed, turned up loudly. "Let's get it on." Ethel whooped and hollered. Frankie realized a moment too late that she was crying. Ethel put an arm around her. "It'll happen for you two," she said. Frankie wiped the tears from her eyes.
"I still think about..."
It took pure strength to finish.
"Rye."
She looked up at Ethel, thought, "Tell me it's okay to love him. Release the shame."
"Forget him, Frank. He's a liar. You're too good for him."
"But I love him. I mean, he is my one."
Ethel gave her a look so hard and sad, Frankie felt its impact in her bones.
"No. He's married, Frank. He is a father. I know you. I know how much you cared for Jamie, but you wouldn't even consider dating a married man. You're a good woman. Honest. Moral to the point of ridiculousness. You couldn't survive an affair."
Each word felt like a nail driving into her, breaking bones. Honest, moral, good.
"No," she wanted to say. "That isn't me anymore."
Frankie made her decision at the reception while she danced to music she didn't recognize, holding Ethel's beautiful daughter in her arms. No more. Enough. She wanted this, a wedding, a family, a baby. How could she possibly be granted such grace after an affair? God and goodness and grace demanded change for redemption. Every moment she spent at the reception, Frankie felt like a liar, a cheat.
She drank too much and was unsteady on her feet when Barb and Jer drove off for their honeymoon.
"Are you okay?"
Ethel asked, standing beside her, holding her hand, looking at her with love and worry in her eyes. Frankie couldn't stand it. Suddenly, she didn't want Ethel to love her, to care about her, to hold her hand. How could Frankie deserve such friendship? She mumbled an excuse, said she was tired or too drunk or just plain sad. She couldn't really remember her words. All she knew was that she needed to leave, now, before she broke down in front of her friend. She took a taxi back to the hotel, gathered up her things, and went to the airport, waiting hours for her flight, long enough to sober up, which only made her feel worse. At home, she sat in her living room, chain-smoking, drinking gin, tapping her foot nervously, waiting for Rye, determined to tell him she'd had enough. She couldn't live like this anymore. When he finally showed up, flowers in hand, she made him stay outside.
"I can't do it anymore," she said. "It's breaking me apart, Rye. I'm sorry, I can't be the other woman anymore. It's wrong."
She waited for him to answer. When he didn't, she took a step back, started to close the door. Slowly, in the new and broken way he moved, he lowered himself to one knee. She could see how much it hurt him to do.
"Will you marry me, Frankie?"
Frankie burst into tears, realizing just then how long she'd been waiting for this, how intensely she needed it. This would right them both, make everything okay, wash her of this sin.
"Yes," she whispered. "Yes."
He climbed painfully back to his feet. She helped him.
"I want us," he said in a gruff voice. "You, me, a baby."
"Thank God,"
Frankie said, pulling him into the house and back to her bedroom. Her whole body was shaking. It would be okay, finally. He leaned toward her for a kiss. She met him more than halfway. Autumn on Coronado Island came late this year, and gradually a turning of the leaves, a need for sweaters at night, an emptying of the beaches. Once again, the restaurants on Orange Avenue were filled with locals instead of tourists. School buses had returned to their routes in the first week of September. To Frankie, these were the things that would always mean fall. On this cool, late November day, almost 10 months after Rye's return from Vietnam, Frankie put on a jacquard-patterned knit dress, parted her long straight hair down the middle, pulled it back into a ponytail, and then drove to the hospital. At the director of nursing's office, she was instructed to wait. Frankie was ready for this meeting, more than ready. In the 2 months since Rye's proposal, she had started to become herself again. They had talked about wedding rings and honeymoon plans and a ceremony on the beach, Kauai for their honeymoon, for another week at the Coco Palms. He was ready to merge into her world, talk to her parents. She couldn't wait to tell her friends and family, Barb and Ethel. Oh, they would look askance at first, maybe wonder at her morality, but she would never tell them that she and Rye had slept together before his divorce. That shame she'd bear alone. "Frankie, she'll see you now." Frankie stood up. Holding her purse close, she walked into the office and took a seat when directed. "Hello, Mrs. Stone," she said, sitting in the ladylike way she'd been taught a lifetime ago when the world had been softer, different. Back straight, chin up, legs crossed at the ankles. She knew she looked better than she had the last time she'd been here. This morning, it had taken only one pill to rouse her spirits. In the past month, she'd cut back.
"I wanted to thank you for suspending me," she said. "I know that sounds odd, but you were right. I was underwater. I might have made a mistake in the OR, and I couldn't have lived with that."
"You're one of the best nurses I've ever worked with," Mrs. Stone said. "But the last time I called you for work, you sounded impaired." Frankie hoped she didn't flinch.
"Just before my first coffee. Moving a little slow, that's all."
"That's all?"
"That's all,"
she lied. "I know about the pain of a miscarriage, and my husband served in Korea. He's told me that some, experiences settle in our bodies as well as our minds. Perhaps you need help dealing with some things? I'm fine, truly. Even if one's experience isn't as traumatic as combat, I'm told wartime can rather upend a man for a time. A man. I'm ready to go back to work, ma'am, Frankie said. I may soon even have some good news to share that will put your mind at ease. Mrs. Stone studied her for a long moment. All right, Frankie. In fact, Karen Ellis called in sick today. Can you finish out her shift? Of course. I still have scrubs in my locker. Frankie stood up. You won't regret it, ma'am. See that I don't. Frankie left the office filled with hope. This was the first step to recovery. She would be herself again in no time. Marry Rye and wear white. Not some off-the-rack prom dress this time. With Rye, she wanted it all. The gown, the veil, the church, the cake. A week later, Frankie stared down at a display of wedding rings in the jeweler's case. May I help you, miss? The clerk asked her. Frankie glanced at her watch. Her shift at the hospital started soon. No, thank you. I guess my fiancé has been detained, she lied. Next time she came to this store, she would bring Rye with her, see what kind of ring he wanted, and show him her favorites. There was nothing wrong or weird with her looking by herself, was there? Leaving the store, she drove across town to the medical center, which rose tall and white against the morning's cloudless cerulean sky. Inside, she changed into her teal-blue scrubs, covered her long hair with a cap, and headed to the surgical floor. She assisted on one surgery after another for hours. At the end of her shift, she checked on her patients and then headed down to the first floor. In the lobby, she saw a crowd of men in suits gathered around the desk. Most were scribbling in open notepads. Reporters. Probably some famous local resident had given birth, like Raquel Welch, who had been Raquel Tejada back when she'd been crowned the fairest of the fair at the San Diego County Fair. Or maybe an actor had died. Frankie headed for the door. As she passed the clod of reporters, she heard someone say, Lieutenant Commander Walsh. Frankie stopped, turned back. Pushing through the reporters, she got to the front of them just as the woman at the desk was saying, We respect our patients' privacy, you know that. You may not speak to them yet. I've called security.
But it isn't every day a former prisoner of war.
Frankie edged around the reporters, ducked behind the front desk, and sidled up to one of the women seated there. The reporters, they want to see some famous guy's wife, a prisoner of war, Walsh. His wife. Is she okay? The woman shrugged. Where is she? 410B. Frankie went to the elevator and pushed the button impatiently. It wasn't until she stepped inside that she realized where she was going. The fourth floor. Ping! The doors opened. She walked slowly down the hallway, feeling suddenly sick. At the last door, she saw the patient's name and stopped. Walsh, Melissa. Frankie pushed the door open just enough to see Melissa Walsh sitting up in bed, surrounded by balloons and flowers and baskets of candy. A soccer ball balloon said, It's a boy. A bassinet was at her bedside. Through the clear sides, Frankie could see a baby swaddled in blue. Frankie backed away quickly, hit something, and turned around. Rye stood there.
Frankie, he said, too softly for his wife to hear. I meant to...
It doesn't mean... She shoved him out of her way, ran out of the hospital, and got into her car, slammed the door shut. Her hands were shaking so hard she dropped the keys. She opened her purse, took out two Valium, and swallowed them dry, then bent down, tried to find her keys on the floor mat. Someone banged on her window. She couldn't look. Had to look. Rye stood there, looking as destroyed as she felt.
I'm sorry,
he yelled. She started the car, stomped on the gas. She had no idea what to do, where to go. She'd fallen for his lies again.
Melissa must have gotten pregnant soon after Rye's return. With Frankie, he'd used condoms. Always. Never a mistake. All these months while he'd been sleeping with Frankie, his wife had been pregnant. When he'd proposed, Melissa had been nearing term. He'd dropped to a knee, said, "Marry me," and Frankie had believed him. She'd believed every smile, every touch, every promise. Believed blindly. Believed when he said, "Soon, baby. Soon we will tell everyone we're together." Oh my God. The only person she hated more than Rye was herself. She needed a drink. It was all she could think of. She couldn't go home to the bungalow where he had clothes in the closet, where he'd dropped to one knee and proposed marriage. She drove past the bar frequented by the hospital staff and drove to San Diego's gas lamp quarter and found a parking spot on the street in front of a tavern where she would be anonymous. She went inside, found it already half full of patrons who looked like regulars. She slipped up onto a bar stool. "Gin on the rocks," she said, "and a pack of Virginia Slims." When the bartender returned with her drink, she barely looked at him. Her hand was trembling as she reached for the glass. "It's a boy!" crashed through her like a wrecking ball, destroying every fragile block of herself she'd tried to rebuild. "I deserve this," she said. "Huh?" the bartender said. "Nothing. Another drink, please." She took the second drink and downed it, then ordered a third. When a good-looking man sat beside her, said, "Hey, foxy lady," she snagged her purse and headed out again. In the car, she cranked up the music on "I Am Woman." She drove out of the crowded quarter. She should slow down. She was going too fast. She sang along with the song, realized she was crying. Ahead was the bridge. She hit the gas, rocketed forward. A stanchion of concrete in front of her, a wall of gray to her right, and then nothing but water. She turned the wheel just a fraction of an inch. A man on a bicycle came out of nowhere. She slammed on the brakes, felt the car spiral out of control on the road, saw handlebars in her headlights. She yanked on the wheel, tried to turn the other way. Too late. 32. Frankie woke in a hospital bed. Her entire body hurt, especially her left arm, and a headache pounded behind her eyes. For a split second, she couldn't remember why she was here, and then, the man on the bicycle, the bridge. Oh God. She heard voices and footsteps coming down the hallway. Her father walked into the room, looking grim and ashamed, angry. Next to him was a policeman with short gray hair. The brass buttons on his khaki uniform strained over a big gut, and a thin dark tie tried to hide the gaps that showed his undershirt. "Did I kill him?" Frankie asked, unable to raise her voice above a whisper.
"No," the officer said. "But you came close, kicked the shit out of his bicycle, came close to killing yourself, too."
"You were drunk, Frankie," her father said. "You could have died."
His voice breaking, he added,
"Can you imagine me having to tell your mother that? Another lost child."
Frankie's throat felt so tight she could barely swallow. She wished she had died. And then a terrible, terrible thought. Had she wanted to? Had she turned into the bridge wall instead of away? Dad looked at the policeman.
"Can I take her home, Phil?"
The policeman nodded.
"Yes. She's being charged with DUI. You'll be notified about her arraignment."
Frankie swung her feet to the side of the bed, slowly stood. She felt dizzy. Dad moved in close, steadied her as she limped out of the hospital, past her fellow nurses who stared at her as she passed. They must have known what she had done, that she'd almost killed a man.
"The man I almost hit. You sure he's okay? You're not lying to me?"
"He's fine, Frankie. Bill Brightman, Coronado High Principal."
Outside, the silver Mercedes Gullwing waited. Frankie refused her father's help and made her own way into the passenger seat. Dad put the key in the ignition and started the car. It roared to life,
but didn't move. After a long silence, he turned to her.
Do you want to die, Frankie? Your mother asked me that.
I shouldn't have had that third drink, she said. I'll do better. I promise.
Enough,
her father said sharply, and she saw it all on his face. The fear that he would lose her, the grief at their mutual loss, the anger that she couldn't seem to be the daughter he wanted. She stared at him, knowing he was right. She could have killed a man tonight. She could have killed herself. Maybe she'd meant to.
I love you, Frankie,
he said in a sad voice.
I know we've had issues, but...
Dad.
You seem broken.
Frankie couldn't meet his worried gaze. I've been living this way for years, she said. Ever since my time in Florence.
Enough.
Alone in her childhood bed, she lay awake, battling her need. Addiction, had she ever thought of it in those terms before? For a sleeping pill and her overwhelming guilt, as well as this new and eviscerating fear that she had wanted to end her own life. Who had she become? A nothing woman, a ghost, no love, no child. How could she survive? Each of the losses had derailed her, but this, now, the guilt and shame of last night, destroyed her. She couldn't live like this. She needed help. Who? How? You should talk to someone. Get help, Henry had said to her. It felt like a lifetime ago, when she'd thought she'd hit rock bottom, but hadn't. I treat a few vets in my practice. Do you have nightmares, Frankie? Trouble sleeping? Who else would understand the slow unraveling of her psyche since Vietnam except her fellow veterans? She'd tried to get help before, once, long ago, and it hadn't worked. That didn't mean she should stop trying. The opposite was true, in fact. She pushed the covers back and got out of bed. Weak on her feet, she went into her bathroom and took a hot shower and dried her hair, then dressed in jeans and a turtleneck. She found her mother in the kitchen, looking tired. Frances, she said softly. Can I take your car? Frankie asked. Mom stared at her so intently Frankie felt uncomfortable, but whatever words her mom needed to hear, Frankie couldn't say. No more promises. They both knew she shouldn't be driving.
The keys are in my bag. When will you be home?
I don't know.
Will you be home?
I will.
She moved forward and touched her mother's thin shoulder, let her hand linger there. A stronger woman would have offered words to accompany the touch, maybe an apology or a promise. She said nothing and went to the garage, climbed into the Cadillac. She took the Coronado Bridge at a cautious speed and pulled up in front of the new VA Medical Center. Frankie parked in the lot and sat there, afraid to move. Finally, she glanced at her black eyes in the rearview mirror. Digging a pair of big sunglasses out of her purse, she left the car and walked up into the building. Inside, she went to the front desk, where a large woman in a floral-patterned polyester dress sat in front of an IBM Selectric, her scarlet nails clacking on the keys.
Ma'am, Frankie said.
The receptionist paused in her typing, but didn't move her hands away from the keyboard, then looked up.
You in trouble, darling? Is your husband angry?
Apparently, the sunglasses weren't much of a camouflage.
I've heard that you offer therapy for Vietnam vets.
There's a rap session at 10. Why?
Where is it?
The woman frowned, pulled a pencil out of her big hair, tapped it on the desk.
Down that hall, second door to the left, but it's only for Vietnam vets.
Thanks.
Frankie walked down the hall, past several men sitting on molded plastic chairs. At room 107, she saw a flyer taped to the textured, frosted glass panel in the top half of the door. Vietnam veterans, share your stories with each other. Rapping helps. She took a seat, waiting, staring at the clock. Her whole body ached and her head hurt, and she felt sick to her stomach, but she didn't move. Her left wrist throbbed.
She looked down, saw a bruise blooming on her pale skin. The door in front of her opened at 9:55. A few men walked into the room. She paused, tried to calm herself, and then she got up, opened the door onto a small, windowless room in which folding chairs had been set up in a circle. Several of the chairs were occupied by men, most of them Frankie's age or younger, with long, untended hair, big sideburns, and mustaches. A few older, grizzled-looking guys sat with crossed arms. More men stood over by a table, eating donuts and pouring coffee from a tall silver urn. Frankie had expected to be the only woman, but she still felt uncomfortable as, one by one, the men turned to look at her. A man approached her. He wore a checkered shirt and cowboy jeans held up by a huge buckled belt. His long, layered hair flipped back from a center part. A huge mustache covered most of his upper lip.
"Can I help you, Foxy Lady?"
he said, smiling.
"I'm here for the Vietnam Veterans Rap Therapy Group."
"It's groovy that you want to understand your man, but this is for veterans only."
"I am a vet."
"Of Vietnam?"
"I am a Vietnam vet."
"Oh, there were no women in Nam."
"Wrong. ANC nurse, two tours, the 36th and 71st evac hospitals. If you never saw a woman, you were lucky. It meant you didn't end up in a hospital."
He frowned.
"Oh, well, you should talk to other chicks about whatever. I mean, you didn't see combat. The men would clam up with a woman in the room."
"Are you telling me I can't stay? I have nightmares, and I'm scared. You won't help me?"
"You don't belong here, ma'am. This is for vets who saw action in Nam."
Frankie walked out of the room, slamming the door shut behind her. She strode down the hallway, saw a "Get Help Here" poster, and ripped it off the wall and stomped on it. MASH was a hit TV show this year. How could people still think there had been no women in Vietnam? Especially veterans, for God's sake. Outside, she let out a howl of rage that she couldn't have held back if she'd wanted to, and she didn't want to. It felt good to finally scream. Frankie had nowhere to go, no one to talk to. She knew something was deeply, terribly wrong with her, but not how to fix it. She could call Barb and Ethel, but it was pathetic how often she'd called on them already. And when they heard about the affair with Rye and driving drunk into the Coronado Bridge, they would judge her as harshly as she judged herself. Still, she had to do something. She could go to the man she'd almost killed and beg for forgiveness. She found a payphone and asked the operator for the address for Mr. Bill Brightman. He lived on Coronado in a small house in the middle of the island. The perfectly tended yard was outlined by bright red flowers and a white picket fence, a house someone loved. She parked by his mailbox, sat outside for a long time, unable to get out of the car, unable to drive away. When she closed her eyes, she saw the accident again and again in slow motion, saw his pale, terrified face in her headlights. The door opened. A middle-aged man with sunken cheeks and black hair stepped out of the house, wearing a brown suit. He was holding a folded-up newspaper in one hand and a battered leather briefcase in the other. Frankie opened her car door, stepped out. He looked at her, frowned slightly. She opened the white picket gate, dared to step onto his property, slowly took off her sunglasses to reveal her black eyes.
"I'm Frances McGrath," she said quietly. "The driver who almost hit you."
She felt tears burn her eyes and wiped them away impatiently. This wasn't about her pain or guilt or shame. It was about his.
"I am so sorry."
"Bring me my mail," he said, lighting up a cigarette.
Frankie nodded sharply, went to his mailbox, pulled out a stack of letters and magazines, and carried them up to the man. On the porch, she handed him his mail.
"I'll replace your bike."
"My bike? Lady, you almost ended me.
he said. Frankie couldn't find her voice. She nodded.
I have a daughter, a wife, a mother, a father. Do you know anything about losing people?
I do, she said.
Remember that. Next time you get behind the wheel drunk.
I'm sorry, she said again, knowing it wasn't enough, but what else was there? He looked at her a long moment, saying nothing, then turned and took his mail back into the house, closing the door behind him. She drove back to her parents' house and parked the car in the garage. Inside the house, she found her mother at the kitchen table. Frankie threw the keys on the table between them.
I'm back, she said dully. You're scaring me, Francis,
Mom said.
Yeah, sorry. Go to your room. Rest. Things always look better in the morning.
Frankie turned slowly.
Do they?
That night, in her childhood bedroom, Frankie came awake reluctantly, fighting consciousness every step of the way. She didn't want to open her eyes and be in a world where she was this version of herself, broken, a fallen woman, a liar. It was all so bad, an avalanche of bad. She reached over to the nightstand, feeling blindly for her pills. She took two more. When had she taken them last? She couldn't remember, didn't care. She closed her eyes, drifted. You almost ended me. Do you want to die, Frankie? It's a boy. Frankie heard a creaking sound and tried to sit up. It was impossible. She drifted in and out, heard footsteps in the hallway. Or maybe it was her heartbeat slowing down to nothing. One of her parents checking up on her, probably. She closed her eyes again and heard someone whisper her name. And then a muffled laugh. Finley. She heard his voice out there beyond the door. In the darkness, she could hear him breathing, could smell the Brill cream he put in his hair and the spearmint gum he loved. Come on, Frankie, be with me. They were kids again. Summer. She heard the ice cream truck outside, bell jangling, kids laughing. She threw back the covers and stepped down onto the cold wooden floor, wondering what had happened to her rug. Finley's laughter echoed in front of her. She followed it out of the house. She grabbed her old surfboard from the garage and stumbled into the pitch-black night. No stars out. No cars rolling on Ocean Boulevard. No house lights visible. She crossed the empty street and stepped onto the cold sand.
Finley, wait up!
She tried to catch up with him, but her legs wouldn't cooperate. She felt weighed down, exhausted. The water was so cold it shocked her, made her gasp. Still, she splashed toward the incoming surf, jumped on her board, and paddled out. She paddled weakly over the swells, made it out to the calm water, lay on her board, panting from exertion. She was shivering with cold and confused.
Finn?
He didn't answer. There was just the lapping sound of the incoming swell set, the smack of her board when it hit back down. She wanted to sit up and look for Finley, but she was too weak. How many pills had she taken? Cold embraced her, numbed her. Was that why she had come out here? A chance to feel nothing? She closed her eyes. She shouldn't be here. She should go back. But she was tired, bone tired, and the cold began to feel good. She could just roll over, sink into the cold sea, and disappear. Red lights, blinking on and off. Incoming. A siren, blaring. Frankie blinked awake. She was in an ambulance, with her father sitting beside her. Water dripped from his hair and clothes. It came back to her in a sickening rush, what she'd done. Shame compressed her into the smallest version of herself. All she'd wanted was to disappear, not something else.
I wasn't trying to... I didn't mean...
She couldn't say the words.
It was a dream. I thought Finley was here. I followed him.
It's those pills,
he said in a voice she barely recognized.
Your mother never should have given them to you. You took too many.
I'll stop taking them.
It's too late for that, Frankie. We're afraid.
Of what you'll do.
You tried to kill yourself.
No, I just...
What? Had she tried to kill herself?
We could have lost you.
She wanted to disagree, to tell him that he would never lose her, that she was fine. But for once, she couldn't say the words, couldn't soldier on.
Why am I in an ambulance? I'm fine now. I'll be good. I promise.
Dad looked uncomfortable, embarrassed. Worse, he looked afraid.
Dad?
The ambulance came to a stop. The attendant jumped out, opened the back door. Frankie saw the words, psychiatric ward. She shook her head, tried to sit up, found that she was bound to the bed at her wrists and feet.
No, please.
36 hours,
Dad said.
A mandatory hold after a suicide attempt. They promised it would help you.
Frankie felt herself and the gurney being lifted. Outside of the ambulance, the wheels snapped into place. Her father was crying. Seeing that scared her more than anything ever had.
Daddy, no, please.
The next thing she saw was bright, bright lights and a team of men in white.
I didn't try to kill myself,
she screamed, struggling to be free. One of the orderlies produced a hypodermic needle. Screaming was the last thing she remembered. 33. Light. Blinding.
Where am I? I lift my head to look around. It feels heavy. Someone else's head on my neck. Maybe I'm paralyzed. Someone says a word, detox, in a long, drawn-out kind of way. And then something about meds. I hear noises that make no sense. I can't sort them out, isolate them, recognize them. Bees buzzing, boots on the ground, humping in the boonies? No, I am not in Nam. Where am I? Screaming. Is that my voice? No. Yes. It's too hard to think. My head is pounding. I close my eyes. Whatever's out there, I don't want to see. Darkness. Quiet.
Frankie. Frankie McGrath, can you hear me?
Frankie heard her name and tried to answer, but her mouth seemed to be stuffed with cotton, and she still had a blinding headache.
Frankie.
It took forever to open her eyes. Lifting her head was next. All she could see were her own hands. Red marks circled her wrists. He came into focus slowly, standing sideways, defying gravity. Maybe her head was tilted to one side. She was blind in one eye. No, her hair fell across her face, obscuring her vision. She raised her hand slowly, felt the tremor in it, pushed the hair back from her face. He stood in front of her. Henry. She felt a rush of shame, and then a burst of relief.
I'm going to get you out of here as soon as I can, okay?
Frankie couldn't make her voice rise above a whisper. Thank you was too much. She got out.
Thank.
He laid his hand on hers. She looked down, wished she could feel his touch. Frankie was having a heart attack. She became aware of the pain all at once, a blinding bolt of it in her chest. She sat up, breathing hard. A headache pounded behind her eyes. Tiny white stars danced across her field of sight. The chest pain turned into a dull, thudding beat in her chest. She was sweating, trembling. Where was she? Dorm room was her first thought. Single bed, low to the ground, cheap blanket and sheets. A dresser with three drawers, no mirror, a closet. She swung her legs around, saw her bare, skinny legs and the borrowed socks on her feet. Headache. Had they drugged her? She felt sluggish,
She got up and immediately felt dizzy, nauseated. She counted to 10, and it passed. What was she wearing? Cut-off shorts, socks, and an oversized tie-dyed t-shirt. Whose? She walked to the door, half expecting it to be locked. Psych ward. That was where she was. She remembered now. The ocean, the ambulance ride, her father crying. She opened the door. Beyond it lay a hallway that looked like the elementary school she'd gone to. Flyers on the wall, linoleum floor, windows that let in so much sunlight she blinked. Construction paper turkeys and pilgrims decorated the walls. Moving cautiously forward, she trailed her fingers along the top of the fake wood wainscoting, just for balance. The headache was bad and getting worse. She passed what looked like a classroom in which people sat in a circle talking. "That was rock bottom," one of them said. "Frances McGrath?" She looked up, saw a young woman coming toward her. A man walked past them, muttering to himself. "Go back to your room, Cletus," the woman said. The woman was beautiful, with doe-like eyes and a waterfall of brown hair. She wore a faded prairie-style dress that fell to her ankles and brown suede Birkenstocks. 6 or 7 wooden bead bracelets encircled her fine wrist. "I'm Jill Landis, one of the counselors here. I run group." She took Frankie by the hand, led her down the hall, past a series of closed doors and a reception area that boasted a banner that read, "Today is the day." "The director has been waiting for you. How do you feel?"
"Headache," Frankie said.
"Weak." "Of course."
She stopped, got Frankie 2 aspirin and a glass of water. Frankie forgot to say thank you, just took the aspirin and swallowed them with water. Jill stopped at a closed door, squeezed Frankie's hand.
"I'll schedule you for group at 2. A rap session helps more than you'd think, especially for vets."
"Group? Rap? I don't want—"
"It's just talking, Frankie. And it's mandatory."
She knocked on the door.
"Come in."
Jill opened the door.
"See ya, Frankie."
Frankie moved forward, 1 foot in front of the other. She was in her stockinged feet. Where were her shoes? The door clicked shut behind her.
"Hey, Frankie."
She looked up just in time to see Henry open his arms for a hug. He wrapped her in an embrace that was as stunning as it was familiar. She looked up.
"You saved me."
He tucked her hair back behind one ear.
"Not yet, and it won't be easy."
He let her go.
"Do you remember what happened?"
"Some of it," she said softly.
The terrible images were there, waiting for her, running into the ocean, hoping to disappear, freezing, her teeth chattering, her dad pulling her off the surfboard, carrying her, an ambulance, her screaming, crying, being restrained. She looked around his office. A window overlooked a park of some kind, a grassy area filled with picnic tables. Beneath the window was a cheap wooden credenza laden with framed pictures and a potted jade plant.
"Where am I?"
"Inpatient therapeutic drug and alcohol treatment facility, at the medical center. It opened about 6 months ago, remember? I run the place and see patients 2 days a week. I won't be your primary therapist, for obvious reasons, but I wanted to ease you into therapy."
"What obvious reasons?"
"I loved you."
Past tense.
"Yeah."
She looked away, unable to meet his gaze, remembered that she'd been in a psych ward for a suicide attempt. Suicide. She couldn't process that terrible word.
"How did you get me out?"
"Your mom called me. She signed you up here for 8 weeks, to start."
"Wow. Mom facing the problem head on. That's new."
Frankie pressed 2 fingertips to her throbbing temple.
"Your headache, by the way, it's withdrawal. You may experience other symptoms. Anxiety, chest pains, sweats, tremors. Also, your cognitive abilities may have been impaired for a while now."
"No shit."
Frankie sighed. Withdrawal. So
So in addition to everything else, I'm officially a drug addict and an alcoholic.
Yay.
The yellow pills you've been taking? Diazepam. More commonly called Valium, but I'm sure you know that. The Rolling Stones called them Mother's Little Helpers.
He went to his desk, pulled out a magazine, opened it to an advertisement with the headline, "Now She Can Cope," which showed a woman in an apron, smiling broadly as she vacuumed.
Docs have been prescribing them like candy to women for years.
Did I lose my nursing license?
You will, at least for a while, but that's not your biggest concern right now.
He took her by the hand, led her to an antique fainting couch.
Sit.
She looked at it, and a bit of her old self rose up, made her laugh.
You're kidding.
I'm a shrink,
he said, smiling back.
It'll make you comfortable talking.
I don't know if I want to be comfortable talking.
Haven't you been uncomfortable and not talking for a long time?
I have a headache. No fair outthinking me.
She sat down, remained upright. Her hands were shaking.
Do you have a cigarette? I don't think I can stand you exploring the murky depths of my soul without some aid.
He found her a cigarette, a lighter, and pulled over a standing ashtray, then positioned his chair next to her. Frankie stood up. She was afraid, agitated. She walked over to the credenza, studied the photographs displayed. Henry's life in images. It made her realize that she hadn't taken a picture in years. She picked up a framed photograph of him and a woman with long, graying brown hair and round, rose-colored glasses.
That's Natalie, he said. We're engaged. She loves me.
Had he meant to put the slightest emphasis on she? Frankie felt both happiness for him and a sliver of pain for herself. Would she be sitting here, head pounding from withdrawal, if she'd married him? Henry smiled.
She's an elementary school teacher and poet. But we'll talk about me later. Right now, I want you to get better, Frankie. My colleague, Dr. Alden, specializes in Vietnam veterans. We're seeing too many addicted military personnel, especially after coming home from the war.
She drifted back toward him, sat down on the ridiculous couch.
No one gives a shit about the women.
Frankie lit the cigarette, drew smoke into her lungs, and exhaled.
Why do you say that?
I went to the VA for help. Twice. They brushed me off, told me to run along, that I wasn't a real vet, I guess.
Why did you go to the VA for help?
Frankie frowned.
I don't know. I just...
Just what?
Henry asked gently. She felt his scrutiny. This was no idle question. He was asking a question Frankie had barely asked herself. She had never answered it aloud, not to anyone. She didn't really want to answer it now. But she was in trouble here, disintegrating, losing pieces of herself. She needed to reach out to someone with her truth.
Well, it's been a rough patch. I almost killed a man because I drove drunk. Then there's the baby, the miscarriage. Rye coming back, lying to me. Our affair. And now I'll lose my nursing license. There's nothing of me left.
That's all the middle, Frankie. You've had trouble sleeping for years, trouble with nightmares. You used to scream in your sleep, he said. Before the baby, the miscarriage. Before Rye.
Frankie nodded.
What about surges of irrational anger, irritation, anxiety?
Frankie couldn't look at him.
Vietnam, he said. That's why you went to the VA. You know Vietnam is the beginning of it all. Do you have memories that are more than memories, that feel like you're there again?
You mean, like...
Like a flashback in a film.
Frankie was stunned. She'd assumed it happened only to her, that she was crazy.
How do you know that?
The 4th of July party, remember?
She couldn't answer.
It's called post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a bit controversial. They haven't added it to the APA manual yet,
but we're seeing similar symptoms in your fellow vets. What you're experiencing is a familiar response to trauma.
I didn't see combat.
Frankie, you were a surgical nurse in the Central Highlands.
She nodded.
And you think you didn't see combat?
My Rye was a POW, tortured, kept in the dark for years. He's fine.
Henry leaned forward. War trauma isn't a competitive sport, nor is it one size fits all. The POWs are a particular group as well. They came home to a different world than you did. They were treated like the World War II veterans, like heroes. It's hard to underscore too much the impact of that on one's psyche.
Frankie thought about all the yellow ribbons on the tree branches in 1973. They hadn't been there when she came home. Hell, they'd had parades for the returning POWs. None of them had been spat on or flipped off or called a baby killer or a warmonger.
And they were pilots for the most part, so their war experience was different than the soldiers or Marines on the ground. In captivity, they banded together, held rank, communicated in secret, all of which strengthened their commitment to each other. We don't really understand PTSD yet, but we know it's highly personal. What about your friends, fellow nurses?
We don't really talk about it.
The war no one wants to remember.
Yeah.
I talked to Barb this week, he said. She told me about the fighting around Pleiku.
He leaned toward her.
Nothing you feel is wrong or abnormal. It doesn't matter what your friends did or didn't experience. You're allowed to be uniquely affected by your wartime experience. Especially you, someone who is idealistic enough to volunteer. You have nothing to be ashamed of, Frankie.
Ashamed. It hit Frankie hard, that word. She had let herself become ashamed. Maybe it had started when she'd been spat on in the airport, or when her mother asked her not to talk about the war, or maybe as news of the atrocities began coming out. Almost every civilian she'd met since coming home, including her own family, had subtly or overtly given her the message that what she'd done in Vietnam was shameful. She'd been a part of something bad. She'd tried not to believe it. But maybe she had. She'd gone to war a patriot and come home a pariah. How do I get back to who I was?
There's no going back, Frankie. You have to find a way to go forward. Become the new you. Fighting for who you were at 21 is a losing game. If that's what you've been trying for, no wonder you're struggling. The naive, idealistic girl who volunteered for war is gone. In a very real way, she died over there.
Frankie stared down at her hands. Died over there. The words resonated keenly. Hurt. She realized just now, sitting here, that she'd known that, felt it, grieved for the innocence she'd lost in Vietnam.
Now, take my hand, he said, pulling her to her feet. I'm going to introduce you to Dr. Aldine.
Dr. Aldine was a quiet, pale man with a thin neck and creased forehead and kind eyes. He gave off a Mr. Magoo vibe that was oddly comforting. In his office, which featured dozens of inspirational photographs, he'd gotten her settled in a comfortable chair and begun to ask her questions. She had wanted to talk about Rye, her heartbreak, her shame and anger, but Dr. Aldine had a different idea.
Memories, he'd said. Vietnam. Let's start there.
At first, it had been difficult to tell her story out loud, but once she said, I remember the first time I saw a traumatic amputation, the floodgates opened and her memories poured out. She realized the power they'd gained by being withheld. In session after session, day after day, she exposed herself and her past, opening up her deepest wounds. She talked about the baby who died in her arms suffering from napalm burns, the expectants who died on sawhorses set in bloody mud, about the young men barely out of their teens who'd clung to her hand, about red alerts and operations on the Quonset floor by flashlight during a mortar attack,
about Mai, the little girl she still sometimes dreamed about. She talked about the terrible suffering of the Vietnamese people. The dark memories gradually gave way to others, also repressed until they'd been nearly forgotten. Like the way the soldiers had cared for each other. So many had refused treatment until a brother in arms was seen. They tried to hold each other together, literally, when horrific wounds had torn their insides out. By the end of the first week, which was a rigidly scheduled combination of group and individual therapy, Frankie was emotionally drained. Dr. Aldean had given her a journal to write down her feelings, and she'd started, slowly, writing about her shame at being here and how much she hated Rai and herself. By the end of the week, she was filling several pages a day. On her third Saturday here, Visitor's Day, she drifted up one hallway and down another, too tense to talk with her fellow patients, too jittery to stop for long, smoking cigarettes one after another, trying to ignore the headache pounding behind her eyes. Now she was at the vending machine, buying another Coke, her latest addiction, when her name blared through the speakers.
Visitor for Frankie McGrath.
Unsure whether she was ready to see anyone, she headed down to the visitor's area, a room near the entrance. It was painted a pretty, calming shade of blue and had pictures of rainbows and oceans and waterfalls on the walls. A corner table held children's toys and boxes of puzzles. A tea-colored poster of Desiderata gave advice for living. Go placidly amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. She sat down in one of the empty chairs, tapping her foot on the floor. Her headache had dimmed but was still there. Her mouth was dry. Sweat dampened her skin. No doubt her parents were walking toward her now, feeling uncomfortable in a place like this. What would they say to her? If they'd been ashamed of her military service, what would they say about addiction, about driving drunk, losing her nursing license, about all of her failures? What would she say to them? Barb came around the corner, looking nervous. When she saw Frankie, she surged forward, yanked her into a hug.
You scared the shit out of me.
Barb held Frankie's hand, led her outside to a grassy area full of chairs and picnic tables, where families sat clustered together, talking. Frankie sat down at a picnic table. Barb sat down across from her.
What the hell, Frankie?
Rai, she said simply. Barb looked confused.
Rai?
He came to see me one night and... No, that's not the start. I saw him at the beach with his family. It feels like a lifetime ago. I followed him like a crazy woman. Then he came to the house and...
And you believed him again?
She leaned forward.
You?
I thought he loved me.
I could kill that son of a bitch.
Yeah, I thought that too. I hated him and myself so much it... destroyed me. That's all I can say. When I first got here, I dreamed of confronting him. I thought I needed to hear, I lied and I'm sorry. But I don't. I know what he did, and I know what I did. None of it is pretty, but he isn't the problem. My doctor and group are helping me understand that. I should have talked about things a long time ago. I should have told you. Frankie drew in a steadying breath and looked at her friend. Her whole body felt shaky, fragile, vulnerable. I should have told you that I was struggling with memories of Nam. Been honest, but you seemed so damn okay. I thought it was all me, that I was weak or broken.
You think, because I don't say anything about Nam, that I don't think about it?
She said.
How would I know? We almost never talked about it.
She paused, took a deep breath, heard Dr. Aldean's even voice saying, Just begin, Frankie. Talk.
I don't know. Why? I can't let some things go. Why I keep remembering when others can forget.
I remember too, Barb said.
I still sometimes have nightmares.
You do?
Barb nodded. Red alerts. Napalm. There was this one night at the 36th. A kid from my hometown.
Frankie held on to her best friend's hand and listened to her stories, her pain, which was like her own. They talked for hours until night fell slowly around them. The stars came out. Frankie had never known before that words could heal, at least be the beginning of healing.
You were a damn rock star in the OR, Barb said at last. You know that, right? Men came home because of you, Frankie.
Frankie drew in a breath, exhaled. I do.
So what's next for you?
It's one day at a time, Frankie said. Truthfully, she wasn't ready to think about her future yet, had no idea if she could believe in the idea of truly healing. She wasn't okay, wasn't even within striking distance of it, and that was something she would never lie about again. But I will be, she thought. She could feel strength growing in her, gathering like sunlight in the distance, beginning to warm her. If she stayed the course, worked the steps, believed in herself, she could heal, be a better version of herself. Someday, she thought.